My name is Spencer Benson. I'm the director of the Center for Teaching Excellence, and it really is my pleasure to co-host this conference with the Office of Informational Technology. One of the great pleasures of being the director of the Center for Teaching Excellence is that myself and my staff, we get to work with great people across campus, and one of the groups I like most working with is the Office of Informational Technology and the staff over there for two reasons. One is that they're always accommodating and they're always overworked, but they find time for us. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you to the first Innovations in Teaching and Learning Conference. This is the first conference on innovations in teaching and learning, but it's not the first conference of this type. It builds upon more than a decade of highly successful, well-attended conferences on teaching with technology. The reason, in part, that we changed the name is that technology and teaching have become almost inseparable over the last decade for lots of reasons. The students that arrive at this university and at all universities grew up in a technologically connected, technologically a world where technology has been part of their existence from cradle to college. To give you an example from my own experience, a decade ago, I'd walk into a classroom and I often didn't have to remind or tell students to turn off cell phones because very few students had cell phones. When you walk into any of your classrooms today and to ask how many of your students have cell phones, actually I'd rephrase the question. It'd be easier to count. How many of you don't have cell phones? And the number would be very low. An interesting piece that has occurred or evolved over that is that 5 years ago, one of the big issues was we always had to remind students to turn off cell phones. And today in my classes, it's very seldom that students have them on or have them on ring mode. But as I look around this room, what I know is that you didn't grow up in a technological world from birth. So would you now take out your cell phone and set it to silence? Because unlike your students, we forget. Which means I should probably check mine. One of the other great things I get to do up here is to thank some people. This conference and putting it together doesn't appear out of thin air. It represents a lot of work in the background by a number of people. A special thanks goes to Deb Maddock, who really has organized this, and her staff, particularly Jung Yang for registration, and Sue Claybaugh, and the instructional facility staff for support. One of the costs of this new technology is you actually do have to have people to support this. It doesn't work automatically all of the time unless it's maintained. And that's the behind-the-scenes piece that the Office of Informational Technology and the technology infrastructure here at the University of Maryland does so well. For those of us at Maryland, we really are blessed with a campus that is highly technology innovated and technology connected. When I travel around the country to other campuses, what we have here is not always present at campuses of equal size. What I want you to do today is to remember three letters. AAE, I want you at the end of the day to have walked away with something that you're going to either adopt, adapt, or enhance. There are a number of wonderful sessions throughout the day dealing with the use of technology and its innovations in teaching and learning. One of the things we've seen is that technology, meaning both the software and the hardware, has truly become a tool that is part of the repertoire of all people who teach, whether they teach kindergarten or graduate classes. But it's only a tool. And like chalk, a blackboard, or a piece of coal, it only works when it's used in an innovative and useful fashion. One of the things that technology and the software has allowed us to do is to change and improve content delivery, the pedagogy we use, the way we build community among students and faculty and peer-to-peer teaching, and the way in which we assess what students learn and how well we are doing. So as you go look through the program, find those sessions that strike your fancy and your interests, and attend them. I'm sure you're going to walk away with something new from this conference. It has occurred every year before, and I'm sure it will occur today. It's really my pleasure now to thank and introduce my colleague, Ellen Borkowski, who will introduce today's speaker.
Thank you, Spencer. Good morning, everyone. And I also want to welcome you all to our conference this year. We're very excited to be changing the focus from just on technology and teaching and learning, but the broader area of teaching and learning. We feel technology is not this separate thing. It's something all integrated into our discussions, so we didn't want to focus just on that anymore in our conferences. So I thank you, and I hope you will enjoy the day today. It's my pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce our keynote speaker for this morning, Dr. Gardner Campbell. Dr. Campbell is a professor of English at the University of Mary Washington, where he teaches literature of the English Renaissance, film studies, and writing. He's also served as an assistant vice president for teaching and learning technologies. He's worked in teaching and learning technologies for over a decade at the University of Mary Washington and the University of Richmond, and currently serves on the advisory board of the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative, the Electronic Campus of Virginia, and the Virginia Learning Technology Advisory Committee. I first heard him actually at the ELI focus session that we hosted here on mobility, which is why we asked him to come here to this conference to do a keynote, because I was very impressed with his talk. He's also a fellow of the Fry Leadership Institute, the class of 2005. He received his BA in English from Wake Forest University and his master's and PhD also in English from the University of Virginia. He's published articles on John Milton, the literature of the English Renaissance, film studies, and information technologies in education. This morning he's going to be speaking to us on the topic of D-School, Reboot, Real School. So please join me this morning in welcoming Dr. Gardner Campbell.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Spencer. And thank you for that lovely introduction, that warm welcome. It's really a terrific privilege to be back here. It was a lovely focus session on mobility and mobile learning almost a year ago. I guess it was March. Here we are again. It's a great opportunity to address you and to get the day going on what looks to be a very impressive conference, a good time of sharing and collaboration. And I really like that AAE approach. I think I'll be taking that one back. I always get my best ideas on the road from other people. With proper citation, it's the scholar's reflex. Where's the footnote? But anyway, thanks very much for the invitation. Thanks for all the hard work folks have done to put this together. And my thanks as well to Deb Maddock for all of her friendly emails and constant encouragement to get all the logistics together. I'd like to start with a game, if that's not too daunting a prospect for this early in the morning. Are you game? Okay. What I'd like to do is something that would be really good with personal response systems or clickers, but I really do not want to push my technological luck this early in the morning, so we're going to use an old-fashioned personal response system. If you know the answer, I'd just like you to shout it out, please. So here's the game. I will read you a mission statement. Some of these are vision statements, but, you know, semantics. You see if you can tell me the company this belongs to, all right? So here's number one, bringing the best personal computing experience to students, educators, creative professionals, and consumers around the world through its innovative hardware, software, and internet offerings. Name the company. Good. I see I have some ringers in the room. Maybe there was a security leak as I was preparing my PowerPoint. Very good, very good. All right, here we go. Number two, to help people and businesses throughout the world realize their full potential. No? Microsoft it is. Very good. All right, here comes the next one. Free access to the sum of all human knowledge. Wikipedia. Very good. Actually, they have about 15 mission statements. That's one of the problems with a wiki. Everybody gets to put their mission on the wiki. But this one I got from Larry Lessig's website, so I'm going to consider that authoritative, all right? Here's the next one. To connect people to their passions, their communities, and the world's knowledge. This is a little bit tougher. We need music for this, don't we? Okay. It's Yahoo. All right. Here's one. To enable people to find, use, share, and expand, you may have heard fuse in there, all human knowledge. Nope, not yet. But I'm sure that the people at Google would love to think that they are the answer to every mission and vision. That's Yahoo Search. Okay, and that acronym FUSE, Find, Use, Share, and Expand is one of the things that they're working with as they try to craft their public face and compete with to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. That's Google. That's Google. That's right. Interestingly, out there on the web, you can find that and useful is a fairly recent addition. So I think at Google, they must be thinking about teaching and learning as well as simply making things accessible. Well, here's my point. There's an interesting pattern here. Business plans for large corporations phrased as utopian visions. These mission statements steadily ascend from the idea of a great product to a vision of comprehensive access to the entirety of global civilization. And that's a radical vision indeed. Moreover, Moore's Law, which accurately predicted and continues to predict the exponential growth of computing power at ever-declining prices, and the high-speed networked computing Moore's Law and the Internet have enabled, means that goals that would have seemed absurd just 10 years ago now stand a reasonable chance of being achieved within the next decade. This is a woodcut of an engraving from Thomas More's Utopia. Utopia means nowhere, but actually it looks like Utopia is coming to a broadband connection near you. In a recent New Yorker article, a Google staffer estimates they will likely finish the digitization of all 7 million volumes in the University of Michigan library in 6 years. Brewster Kahle of the Internet Archive speaks with confidence of a time in which a new kind of bookmobile will not circulate single copies of books, as bookmobiles do now, but access any of the world's books in any language and print that book on demand for $10 or less as the bookmobile drives through cities and countrysides all over the world. I could produce many more examples. You probably have some of these marvels in your pockets or in your purses, from the mapping of the human genome to robotics and beyond. If Ray Kurzweil were here, how many of you heard Ray Kurzweil at EduCause? Yeah, pretty inspiring stuff. He would not only bring you gadgets and visions to boggle your mind, he would insist that within the next 2 decades, we will encounter what he terms the singularity. That's a moment in which the extensions of memory, computing, motion, and experience that we have built for ourselves become integrated into our very notion of self and thus transform what it means to be human. Not everyone agrees with Kurzweil's vision. I myself think his vision has some interesting gaps and some troubling implications, but there is no denying the accelerating change that he points to. Clearly, we live in a world where visionaries are busting out all over, and they are thinking more boldly and dreaming more dramatically than ever before. So where, then, are the utopian visions of education? Is there a singularity in the future for school? There's no lack of talk about educational reform. Many people talk about transforming teaching and learning. I'm adding to that pile today. I'm old enough to have lived and even worked through what seems to be at least 2 or 3 cycles of talk about transforming teaching. teaching and learning. And yet, sometimes it seems as if no matter what we do, that specter of no significant difference continues to haunt what appear to be our very best efforts. Books like The Flickering Vision, anyone heard of or read that book here? It's got some weak points, but it's worth taking a look at. Books like The Flickering Vision, which may be reductive in their arguments and analyses, point to a truth that those of us who work in teaching and learning technologies really do have to confront, I think. For all the talk we've heard for nearly three decades of how computers are going to revolutionize teaching and learning, we haven't seen that revolution yet. Well, my talk today is not going to usher in that revolution. I can't pretend to have any final answers or even persuasive provisional conclusions. But in my own work as a scholar, a teacher, an administrator, I have seen the transformational promise of computing. I think that's what draws us here today. We all see that that promise is there. On an intuitive and an experiential level, I've seen things happen in the classroom because of computing that would not otherwise have happened. And I continue to search for a conceptual framework that would help me to understand why those good things did happen, why they mattered, and how I can help them to happen more consistently. So today I'd like to share with you some of the ideas I've been considering lately. Here are your responses to them. I'll be giving you some examples from my own current practice in the classroom, but it's mainly ideas I want to talk about, to think together about with you, as we journey together for a few moments this morning in the quest that I believe we share. Scope of what I want to say is morphed a little bit from what's in your program. I hope that turns out to be okay. I want to start by thinking about Ivan Illich, whose work I've only begun to explore. Some of you probably know his work far better than I do, and I would be very grateful to learn from you. Illich's vision of what he calls deschooling, and I like to call real school, and I'll talk some more about that term later, is a bold vision. It's a troubling vision. I think it's radically insightful. Illich was born in 1926. He got a PhD in history. He eventually became a priest in the Roman Catholic Church, eventually left the priesthood over some disagreements with points of Roman Catholic doctrine. He spent most of his life working in the Third World, which is a term that he did not himself employ. He was firmly opposed to the paradigm of industrialization that divided the world into developing nations and developed nations. When he died in 2002, his obituary in The Guardian hailed him as, quote, one of the world's great thinkers, a polymath whose output covered vast terrains. He worked in 10 languages. He was a jet age. There's an irony there. He did get on jets, though he did not believe in high-speed interstate highways. He was a jet age ascetic with few possessions. He explored Asia and South America on foot, and his obligations to his many collaborators led to a constant crisscrossing of the globe in the last two decades of his life, end quote. That obituary goes on to note that Illich's ideas were criticized and even disdained by both the right wing and the left, and it summarizes his accomplishment by saying, quote, he was far more significant as an archaeologist of ideas, someone who helped us to see the present in a truer and richer perspective than as an ideologue. The New Criterion concluded with this simple phrase, quote, being not easily pigeonholed, he forces us to think. Illich's seminal work is called Deschooling Society, and it is a radical book indeed, as the blurb up there says, good radical stuff. Illich was very pessimistic about any kind of compulsory, curriculum-driven, aged-organized schooling. That is, the schooling that about 90% of us will experience as we go through our lives. That's probably a low estimate. Illich makes a very trenchant economic analysis of the bad effects of universal schooling. He's full of aphorisms and lovely barbed comments. And that economic analysis is very important, as well as controversial and provoking. At times, it's hard to believe what he says is really something he believes when he says, for example, no one ever learned anything from a teacher. You have to, especially if you earn your living that way, step back a moment and say, now, wait a minute, what am I doing now as I read your book, Professor Illich? But for all of that, what I'd like to focus on today is his even larger point, that institutional schooling, as we know it today, is constructed in a way that cannot help undoing its very aims. As he memorably puts it, quote, "Any attempt to reform the university without attending to the system of which it is an integral part is like trying to do urban renewal in New York City from the 12th story up. Most current college-level reform looks like the building of high-rise slums." End quote. Good radical stuff. Illich's arguments are not easy to summarize. In one sense, he makes the same point over and over, as many weary readers have noted. That's a trait he shares with many visionary thinkers, in my experience. And at the same time, the individual points he does make are so interwoven that it's difficult to disentangle them and present them as discrete items. Nevertheless, I'd like to at least try to isolate three main considerations to frame the way we think about him and that underlie his criticism of the way, as he puts it, the idea of education as a thing one gets has replaced the idea of learning, a thing one does. First, for Illich, compulsory schooling replaces desire with require, and thus defeats its own purpose. If you've ever taught a class and asked the students why they're taking it, and they say to fulfill a requirement, and that only happens to me about 50 times a semester, you get that sinking feeling of, oh boy, engagement, where have you gone? This is what Illich writes, quote, "Universal education through schooling is not feasible. It would be no more feasible if it were attempted by means of alternative institutions built on the style of present schools. Neither new attitudes of teachers toward their pupils, nor the proliferation of educational hardware or software, nor finally the attempt to expand the pedagogue's responsibility until it engulfs his pupils' lifetimes, will deliver universal education. The current search for new educational funnels must be reversed into the search for their institutional inverse, educational webs, which heighten the opportunity for each one to transform each moment of his living into one of learning, sharing, and caring." End quote. A utopian vision. It's easy to see that Illich downplays the inevitable developmental dilemma that we all face in the classroom. Our students are not often knowledgeable or sometimes even mature enough to be able to say what it is they most need to learn. If we've proved anything in this early part of the 21st century, it's that most people will eat junk if it's cheap and plentiful, even if nutritious foods are also cheap and plentiful. Similarly, the society we inhabit furnishes us all with enough cognitive popcorn to distract us from the real intellectual banquet we should be preparing ourselves for. That said, turning funnels into webs is exactly the right metaphor, I believe, for the transformation we seek. And the web he's writing about, which we'll see in a minute he calls a learning web, he's writing about in 1971, long before the advent of the World Wide Web. Second, Illich believes that institutional schooling structures itself around compulsory meetings instead of meaningful encounters. It's not just those of us who sit on committees or have to meet with various groups across campus who find ourselves in a Dilbert universe. Our students do as well. Sometimes I think students view classrooms the way those of us on staff and faculty view cubicles. Illich writes, quote, "The modern university has forfeited its chance to provide a simple setting for encounters which are both autonomous and anarchic, focused yet unplanned and ebullient, and has chosen instead to manage the process by which so-called research and instruction are produced." End quote. Elsewhere, Illich insists that nearly all real learning happens outside of contact with a teacher in a classroom. And to be fair to him, our current research on informal learning suggests that he is on to something there. But his larger point, as I understand it, is not just that we don't have enough informal or flexible learning spaces. It's that the very idea of the serendipitous encounter is largely missing from the way educational institutions manage their processes. for the paradoxical reason that serendipity, by its very nature, resists management, especially as management and operational goals become ends in themselves. Too frequently, I think, we keep the trains running without ever asking, why these trains? On these tracks? Why running to these destinations? But if we cannot manage serendipity, we may yet be able, using Illich's words, to create environments that not only foster focused, yet unplanned and, this is a key word, ebullient encounters, but clearly anticipate that they will occur. Sadly, the typical classroom or lab is not one of those environments. When I walk into a classroom to teach, the invitation that the room extends to me is not really palpable, except here we go. That has to be created by the people in the room. That's important too, but it would be nice to have a little more inviting stage set for the drama of learning. Third, for Illich, curricular certification has replaced authentic measures of knowledge. You know, we're getting to the A word now, assessment. He believes that authentic measures of knowledge revolve around range and effectiveness of action, not simply an accounting of credit hours or assignments completed. The very notion of contact hours or credits earned was anathema to Illich, who thought modern processes of scaling and managing education, which is really what those measures are about, were particularly sinister in their effects because they caused a fundamental confusion in the student's mind. I'm earning credits, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like stacking coins. Assessment should not exist within a system of temporally driven certification. We can no longer measure learning by clocks or grades alone. In this sense, I believe, Illich would be very interested in the idea of e-portfolios, but only if the student, him or herself, not only assembled the content, but constructed the very portfolio infrastructure. It won't do simply to build a container the student pours things into. In many ways, that's the same paradigm as bringing in the student as a container and pouring the content in. If you don't allow the student to construct the very infrastructure, the school will always frame the presentation just the way a frame surrounds a diploma. Instead, I would submit to you that our students need to be the frame in which we operate. Illich writes, quote, "In a de-schooled society, professionals could no longer claim the trust of their clients on the basis of their curricular pedigree or ensure their standing by simply referring their clients to other professionals who approved of their schooling. Instead of placing trust in professionals, it should be possible at any time for any potential client to consult with other experienced clients of a professional about their satisfaction with him by means of another peer network easily set up by computer or by a number of other means." It sounds uncomfortably like rate your professor, which is not exactly what I would like to see. Nevertheless, bear with me, bear with Illich. Such networks could be seen as public utilities which permitted students to choose their teachers or patients their healers. End quote. Though he was as critical of the information age as he was of the industrial age, Illich did believe that computers could be extremely valuable for their facilitation of what he called, prophetically, learning webs, in which those who desired to learn could easily find those who desired to teach. And I urge you to read the Schooling Society to get the full heft of this argument, which I have no time to go through in detail today, but his vision is not just of a rateyourprofessor.com. It really is of a way in which those who seek find those who want to be sought. It's the old saying, when the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear. For him, the computer allows that to happen more frequently, or potentially could do that. One's credentials in this world would be wholly based on reputation. Now, this vision is also familiar to us from the myriad opportunities we have online to rateyourbook.com, rateyourmovie.com, rateyourwebsite.com. That is, to rank, review, promote, dig, and share our discoveries. Most of the user-generated content in what Tim O'Reilly has led us to call Web 2.0 could be understood as an instance of this idea of the learning web. And this is what companies are counting on to sell their products now. This is why those utopian visions are so compelling to me. A learning web is being constructed largely outside of school. This learning web is a kind of peer network leading us to trusted sources of judgment and learning. Interestingly, in this same book, 1971, Illich also uses the term learning objects. He may have been the inventor of that term. I can't find an earlier use. To describe what seemed to be mini tutorials or reusable skill building modules that could be located within such learning webs. Now, it's greatly to Illich's credit, I think, that he does offer such a powerfully positive vision of true learning, for his critique of Western industrially scaled education is so thorough that deschooling society might easily have been nothing but negative. Lest we think Illich's radical critique is isolated, however, some nut writing in the 1960s, I would like to share with you a similar cry for reform that I know several of you heard with me at the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative annual meeting just a few weeks ago. Chris Deedy of the Harvard Graduate School of Education was one of the keynote speakers there. And, of course, I was my mind was swirling with all the ideas I wanted to share with you today. So you can imagine when I heard him say, "Our assumptions about learning are fundamentally flawed," I thought, whoa, this man's been reading my mail. About midway through his talk, he delivered his own manifesto. This is one whose scale and passion Illich himself would have applauded, and I'd like to play it for you now.
Our assumptions about learning are fundamentally flawed. I want to describe three kinds of common human behaviors and put them on a continuum from simple to complex: sleeping, eating, and bonding. People are pretty much alike in the way that they sleep. If you're designing hotel rooms, it's pretty easy to create a hotel room that works for anybody across any culture in terms of what they need to sleep. Eating is much more variable. People like to eat very different things, and they like to eat them in very different ways. They like the eating experience to be quite different. So if you're designing a restaurant, not just the architecture, but the menu and the style of dining that goes on, there's incredible variety. Bonding is more complex still. People bond to pets. People bond to sports teams. People bond to people who are like them, who are opposite to them. They bond sexually. They bond platonically. They bond to groups. People who study bonding are struck by how incredibly rich and varied it is. We treat learning like sleeping. But everything we know about learning suggests that it's like bonding, or at least like eating. And yet the very, very best of our high-end learning environments have less variety than a bad fast food.
I don't know why that cut off. A bad fast food restaurant is what he goes on to say. As I read Illich, as I listen to Chris Deedy, and I wait for the next one of those uncanny moments where somebody reads my mind and says exactly what I'm hoping we'll hear, I wonder what it will take to instill the sense of urgency in the educational establishment that I love, that I came up through, that I feel not only committed to, but I feel defines me. What is it going to take that's going to lead to the kind of radical action these thinkers are calling for? And assuming that we have the will to reboot, which you know is the answer to every computer problem, assuming we have the will to regain our powers of deep invention in the service of learning, what should we do? How can we work together to create that real school in which, as Jerome Bruner writes, we truly raise consciousness about the possibilities of communal mental activity? What will take us from sleeping to bonding? What's going to get us to Ed 2.0? I truly believe that high-speed networked computing can effect educational transformation, but not until we analyze the deep structures of meaningful human interaction and learning, and then think together about how computers can augment those deep human realities, which are enduring realities, not how these tools can commodify or automate the administration of services, though I too find Blackboard convenient. In the time I have left today, then, I want to explore what I think are five crucial elements we should remember as we work together to construct our real schools. Schools motivated by a genuine hunger for learning, a celebration of our communal mental activity, not simply grades or degrees. These elements listed, now this is Reboot, by the way. Anybody seen that cartoon? These elements, with the thinker who for me best represents their nature and importance, are conviviality, which comes again from Ivan Illich, play, which I think of in terms of Vygotsky, an educational and cognitive and linguistic theorist, metaphor, which I take from Lakoff and Johnson, the idea of an integrated domain, which comes from Doug Engelbart, and then finally the idea of addressivity, which is a term that Mikhail Bakhtin, who's a literary and linguistic theorist, uses. So let's start with conviviality. Turning again to Illich, this is the book that comes after Deschooling Society, and while it is, if anything, even more withering than Deschooling Society, he actually does sketch out a vision of the larger society that he believes humane tools should enable. And I want to think of this in terms of computers. Convivial tools are easily used. Convivial tools are widely accepted, accessible, excuse me. These tools are not obligatory. They are responsive to purpose. These tools permit others to use their tools unimpeded. They require no certification for their use. And they allow the user to express his meaning in action. Conviviality is, Illich writes, quote, individual freedom realized in personal interdependence. Individual freedom realized in personal interdependence. A convivial society, he writes, would be the result of, quote, social arrangements that guarantee for each member the most ample and free access to the tools of the community and limit this freedom only in favor of another member's equal freedom, end quote. This decentralized, interdependent society is not unlike the original design for the Internet. And perhaps we can argue for net neutrality on the basis of this idea of conviviality. Closer to the ground, however, we can look at Illich's 7 criteria for conviviality and look at the digital tools we use in higher education and the digital environments we create to see how well they promote or exemplify this idea of conviviality. Can a course management system be convivial? Conviviality for Illich fosters eutropelia, which is a word that means graceful playfulness. And I love to think about these two things together: individual freedom realized in personal interdependence and the idea of graceful playfulness, eutropelia. I need more eutropelia in my classroom, that's for sure. Now I want to think about play. This is a terrific essay. I love this essay by Vygotsky on the role of play in development. And he's talking about children, but I think that his remarks can be extended to any learner. I certainly find this to be true as I continue to learn. The teaching and learning technologies we create and use should promote a sense of play. Vygotsky writes, quote, superficially, play bears little resemblance to the complex mediated form of thought and volition it leads to. Only a profound internal analysis makes it possible to determine its course of change and its role in development. Vygotsky is the one to go to for the profound internal analysis. I'm just going to summarize a bit of what he says. Play is not just entertainment or diversion. I would say that play is play in the sense of playing music or putting on a play. There should be a sense of occasion, a freedom to experiment, a freedom to act out what one imagines. This, Vygotsky believes, is central to cognitive development. Play is what we mean when we say to think out of the box. In play, Vygotsky says, thought is separated from objects and action arises from ideas rather than from things. That is, play, as Vygotsky understood it, is a strange and wonderful exercise in which we take what we really see before us, a chair, a table, a set of pixels on a monitor, and act with it as if it is something else. In this sense, play allows us to enter a persistent virtual world that we all have inside our own minds and interact with our surroundings constrained only by our imaginations. In fact, I think that it's precisely this playful interaction that leads our imaginations to create change within our surroundings. Vygotsky writes, from the point of view of development, creating an imaginary situation can be regarded as a means of developing abstract thought. It's the very thing I want my students to do, and if I can't find a way to prompt it, or they can't imagine it, they come back with a report on what they found in the library. That's a first step, but it's not abstract thought. Abstract thought becomes possible when we're no longer bound by the material world, even though we are still responsive to it. In play, we create together a world of pure possibility, and the energy of that creation allows us to think in new ways with genuinely fresh ideas when we enter the world we all really inhabit again. Computers, it seems to me, are obviously such a playground. It's one of the things that make them so compelling. For Vygotsky, quote, play creates a zone of proximal development. As in the focus of a magnifying glass, play contains all developmental tendencies. That is, if you watch somebody at play, you'll see the whole course of thinking, imagining, and developing abstract thought, and is itself a major source of development. Here I am at play, riding an eagle far above the NMC campus in Second Life. Anybody here in Second Life? It's a terrible, rowdy frontier. Way too much sex. Way too much crazy stuff going on. It's a world that we've built together. It looks oddly like the world we inhabit, but it's malleable. I'm not giving up on it yet. If you haven't been inside Second Life or to the NMC campus, the New Media Consortium campus, I highly recommend it. There's some very exciting stuff going on there. Secondly, our use of computers should be steeped in metaphor. In their wonderful book, Metaphors We Live By, Lakoff and Johnson argue that all conceptual thinking is inherently metaphorical because all conceptual thinking involves mapping one domain onto another, what we know, where we start, with what we don't know, where we're going. So to think is to connect, to perceive resemblances, and thus to forge new understandings. And that process is inherently metaphorical. As they write, metaphors are not merely things to be seen beyond. They're not just a stepping stone. In fact, one can see beyond them only by using other metaphors. It is as though the ability to comprehend experience through metaphor were a sense like seeing or touching or hearing, with metaphors providing the only ways to perceive much of the world. Metaphor is as much a part of our functioning as our sense of touch and as precious. Network computing is a powerful metaphor engine. The World Wide Web is built on links, and those links are acquiring more semantic weight each moment. I'd argue that semantic linking is most intensely promoted in the blogosphere, where conversations are richly distributed by means of hyperlinks that not only connect ideas, but alert bloggers when they have been connected to. This was my first aha moment when I started blogging a couple of years ago. I suddenly understood that when I connected to somebody else who was blogging, they knew that automatically, and these conversations could emerge without anything more than people making these links. I think the trackback and the pingback are the overlooked marvels of the blogosphere. In this way, the World Wide Web is almost a metaphor for metaphor itself. It's a carrying over, a linking that enacts a kind of understanding. Now, that sounds pretty grand, maybe grandiose. I sometimes despair that the signal-to-noise ratio on the web is too low to sustain intelligent life. I bet you have those moments too. But then I'll get a comment on my blog. or stumble on something on the internet, and I get that same old thrilling sensation. It's as if you can see civilization blooming before your eyes, the way you can see a flower bloom in a time-lapse photograph just within a few moments. This is one example of what I'm talking about when I speak of the web as a metaphor engine. This actually comes from the Radio 4 BBC podcast, In Our Time. I want you to hear what he says about this idea of iso-thinking.
It's very important, this point, because when we think of all these measurements and we think of all the way in which they're seen as part of a balance and so forth, the way that Humboldt really liked to express that was through maps that showed measurements connected together through lines, in other words, through isomaps. And so when we look at something like a modern weather map, we're looking at the kind of map that Humboldt invented. This was a new invention. If you look at old maps from the 18th century, topographic maps even, they tend to show little bump-like pimples for mountains. If you look at a 19th century map, they show the kind of contour lines that we're familiar with. That's the sort of mapping that Humboldt really put forward and really expressed. And for him, that kind of iso-thinking was really central to the way that an individual could understand the whole earth and the
way that it worked. What I'm imagining for education, or hoping for anyway, is a new map of just this kind, built not on isolated courses taken sequentially, but on connections and connectivity. Or maybe it's an old map newly realized, a way of taking that core experience of learning, the bonding Chris Deedy discusses, and finding a way to make it, not the processes and administration of school, central to the experience of learning. If you've ever been in a faculty discussion about curriculum reform, you start to feel like it's deck chairs on the Titanic. One more gen ed curriculum. This time we'll get the rubrics right. This time it will be modes of creativity. No, no, no. This time it will be human potential. No, no, no. What the category is this time. But in some ways, it doesn't change the basic system. These networked computers, by the way, the ones that allowed me to listen to this podcast, compose this address, and eventually share it with others not present today, promote and exemplify a new kind of cognitive map, if we can see it. It's what Chris Deedy calls distributed cognition. If we can get our minds around that, I think we can have not only iso-thinking, but an educated imagination. That's one of Humboldt's maps with those new iso markings on there. Very familiar to us now. Nobody had thought this way before. And what about that imagination? Another one from the In Our Time series, this time talking about an Islamic philosopher from the 13th century, Averroes, reaches for an even bolder analogy. Here's what he says.
It's not something that belongs to you and me. I mean, we would naturally think of the four of us as each having our own intellect and our own thoughts and so on. For Averroes, that's not really so. We, each of us has our own imagination. That's something personal and private. But really intellectual thought, that is something that happens in a single universal intellect. It's very difficult to understand this. I try to explain it to people that he thought of the intellect as being something like the internet, that as the, you know, there's all this information on the internet, and occasionally we tune in to bits of it. So for Averroes, as it were, the imagination is a kind of Google that links up from time to time into the great body of
disembodied science, that is, knowledge. Using computers as possibility generators, not simply as productivity tools, can help to strengthen and augment the imagination, which is that human capacity that allows us to formulate questions and illuminate our search for the answers. Next, I believe our IT tools should always look to create what Doug Engelbart calls an integrated domain, which he defines this way. We refer to a way of life in an integrated domain where hunches, cut and try, intangibles, and the human feel for a situation usefully coexist with powerful concepts, streamlined terminology and notation, sophisticated methods, and high-powered electronic aids. This is from an essay that he wrote in 1962. Engelbart's point is that computers should always be used to augment human intellect, to help us understand and unify our own modes of thought and expression. As he put it in a talk not long ago, True information fluency is not about personal computers, but about personal computing. That is, about using the tools creatively and purposefully. As an example, consider mobile computing. Most of our students now bring laptops, not desktops, to school with them. But in most cases, they do not bring their computers into the classroom. There are practical reasons for this. Laptops are still fairly heavy and bulky. Battery life is always a concern. Lately, battery explosions have become a concern as well. Nevertheless, mobile computing in a wireless environment has enormous potential for distributing information gathering, creativity, and communication during class meetings. Much of the time, however, if students do bring them, they seem to be a nuisance. They appear to threaten the learning environment and function more like DVD screens in the family van than they do like tools to augment and extend the experience of active learning. Engelbart would say that this situation results from a lack of integration, and that as long as computers are used for business as usual by other means, they will be little more than glorified typewriters or distraction zones. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, I'm skipping a little bit here because I have some examples I want to share with you. Teaching and learning technologies, I think, must always be built on principles of addressivity. This is a word that the Russian linguist Mikhail Bakhtin used to describe what he called, quote, the quality of turning to someone. It's that moment in speech communication when you feel that someone has turned to you and is inviting and anticipating your response. Such a feeling is at the very heart of bonding. As we consider the addressivity of our technologies, then, we should consider not only interaction, but invitation. How can we build addressivity into our technologies? I would argue that our current course management systems, structured as they are around individual courses, locking away the process of learning behind the walled gardens of environments built in many cases as little more than an easy-to-use document distribution system, do not invite our students' responses or their creativity or their involvement. They do not offer possibilities for bonding. My colleague at the University of Mary Washington, Martha Burtis, has noted that a large part of this failing resides in our stubborn insistence in making the individual course of study the basic administrative unit of the college experience. And I think she's right. But what can we do instead? Where might addressivity lie in our computing environment and the tools that connect to it? One answer, I think, is the customized personal learning environment, which can be built in several ways by both instructor and student. Take, for example, a simple discussion forum. In Blackboard, if you've used a discussion forum, you get something that looks very plain and is organized You get in there and you get a screen of text. That's pretty much it. Not enough. If you have a simple free discussion forum tool like PHPBB, which has also the great advantage of being bog standard and an essential staple of the student's online experience. They interact with discussion forums like this all the time. You have an environment that I would say is fuller, more capacious of addressivity. When we get into one of these threads, let's pick the one on Syriana here. You will see that there are opportunities for the student to choose a username, an avatar. This little thing here is one of my favorite stealth teaching techniques. I try to reward frequency of posting with secret ranks. As they come to 10 posts, they get a rank. Suddenly, you know, gaffer appears. This is a film course. If they've posted 20 times, suddenly they're a producer. 30 times, suddenly they're a director. I say nothing about this to them. Inevitably, during the class, they'll say, why are these things appearing here, Dr. Campbell? And I'll say, I don't know. Why do you think they're appearing there? And we'll have a little discussion. This person had posted a number of times in this class and is now a multinational entertainment conglomerate. And has picked an avatar, Groucho Marx, and has the opportunity to have a SIG file, that is, a little motto, a little something to carry around as a marker of their identity. There's an opportunity to fill out a profile that can be shared with other members of the class. You can send a personal message within the system. You can link to their email if they choose to allow you to do that. you can link to their AIM account if they choose to allow you to do that. Some students will link off to their websites, to their own blogs. This is free. I host it on a server space that costs me $7.95 a month. Gives me 1 terabyte of bandwidth for transfer, 200 gigabytes of storage. I installed this by clicking a link. Now, there are all sorts of ways in which you're going to encounter arguments about scalability, sustainability, privacy, etc. Those are important arguments. They are second considerations, I would say. First, get the addressivity right. I have to tell you that I used Blackboard discussion forums for a long time in my film classes. They were always very active. The first time I used this tool, frequency of posting doubled. Okay, I said, I guess I had better think about this. Another answer I would say for addressivity is the blog. I'm using this particular, this is not my main blog, but this is a blog front end that I'm using to organize my classes this semester so that students, no matter what class they're taking, can see what other classes I'm teaching. The idea is learner connected with teacher, not a silo for a course of study. And one of the things that my tremendous colleagues at the University of Mary Washington indulge me in and have helped me to do is to create an entire blog site with WordPress multi-user, which is free, running on a hosting server that costs $7.95 a month for, well, you heard that already, to create an entire class blog site, unified, in which the feeds from all of the class blogs appear automatically, are updated. You can at a glance see the activity of all the bloggers in the class. You can click on the little feeds over here and see, as soon as it loads, a little list of the latest blogs. I think my colleague has loaded about 30 different themes into this blog site, which means that students have ample opportunities for customization, for personalization of the way they present themselves as learners. Here's an example. This is from the blog Dancing Bread Rolls, which the student named. They'll lead themselves. They will lead by their own examples. Not every student is this savvy with the tools, but every student can see what this student is doing. They can link to each other. They can comment on each other's blogs. They will learn from each other's example. And if a student wants to know more, I know where to take them. Here's another one. I love the title. Things That Perplex Jimmy Stewart's Disembodied Head. I just don't think you'd get that in a course management system. So as soon as this loads in, you will see we're doing a unit on Little Women in this film class right now, and the Beth question has occupied us a great deal. This student, when I said we're going to be blogging in this class, asked me a question which was a moment of addressivity for me. And I think if we are open, we may hear these questions more and more. He said, oh, we're going to blog. That's good. May I use my own space for that? Okay, absolutely. So he uses his own space. We very easily link it in. It's part of the same community as the blog site that we've set up on our own hosted system. And there he is. He's created this particular blog. It's one of three that he has. And he's working with the Beth question. This same student, after seeing one of the films on the syllabus, took the DVD, created 100 screenshots, put them in a zip file, and available for anybody who wanted to use them in their own analyses. They're just posted on his blog. I didn't ask him to do that. I never thought he would do it. I never anticipated that. I'm very glad that he did. Multi-user virtual environments like Second Life also afford tremendous possibilities for collaboratively built environments that not only permit creativity, but invite it. And I can even imagine what I've called, in an article that came out last fall, the Odyssey Project. This is as far out as my imagination can get right now, in which we do not create, for example, e-portfolio systems for our students, but upon matriculation, we give them a virtualized server space. We say, pick a domain. This is how you will present yourself as a learner in this community. much as commercial hosting services do now. We could do this with a broad set of open source, dynamic content management tools that the students will explore and create for themselves. Our job, then, is to equip students in digital citizenship, what they'll need to exercise for the rest of their lives, lead students to take charge of their own digital destinies, from data backup and migration to information architecture. These are the tools they will need. These lessons can start very simply at the level of the blog and expand during the student's career into designs and creations limited only by their imagination. This was my just-in-case set of slides. In 1982, Illich sounded a warning about computers that echoed his warning about school, as he foresaw a time in which human communication would be thwarted, not fostered, by the machines we created. Quote, "Just as the commons of space are vulnerable and can be destroyed by the motorization of traffic, so the commons of speech are vulnerable and can easily be destroyed by the encroachment of modern means of communication." If, on the other hand, our tools are truly convivial, if they enable shared play, if they're attentive to metaphor and the learning it enables, if they aim at an integrated domain, and if they're built around addressivity, the quality of turning to someone, I would argue their numbing or even destructive potential can be minimized, and they can become agents of transformation as we all strive together toward the creation of real school. Most of all, real school must begin and end with faith in the possibilities of meaning. I actually blogged about this. One of my colleagues, who is a tremendous agent provocateur, is an economist, I don't know, maybe it comes with the discipline, alerted a student who was blogging in his class to my blog. She was very timid about linking to my blog, but eventually did it and responded to what I was saying, and it was great for me. What I was saying was that students enter school as a set of tasks to complete, not as opportunities for meaning making. And I return to this poem by Robert Browning, Fra Lippo Lippi, an artist who in the end says, "This world's no blot for us, nor blank. It means intensely and means good. To find its meaning is my meat and drink." I think our students confuse information, which belongs to them and is created for them by their interaction with the world, with the vehicles for potential information that we build, which are, after all, a lot easier to plan for and to assess. As we develop our tools and our technologies, we will always confront the problems of scalability and sustainability. Sometimes IT work feels a lot like this. But those problems must not constrain our imagination or our innovation. In the end, the only real source of scalability and sustainability is the individual user, the individual student. Otherwise, we design systems that use us, not systems that we use. Real school should be like Frost's description of the work of poetry. Every learning opportunity, every learning community should begin in delight and end in wisdom. I think computers can help to make that happen. Addressivity, the quality of turning to someone, when mixed with eutropelia, graceful playfulness, readies the mind and heart for real school. This is the promise I've seen with computers. It's the promise I believe computers can enable and augment and catalyze. To settle for anything less would be a crime. Thank you.